Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm well indeed. I'm feeling still a little recovering from the Easter holiday weekend a little bit.
It was quite a little holiday, wasn't it?
I find that as I get older, I need to detox a day after a feast. I never used to. I could have a feast and then the next day go out for a feast and then go out drinking for beers. And I need a little resting time in between.
Yeah,
like
well,
a great lamb roast.
Back in the day, we'd go feast drinking. It's kind
of and that's why we look at the way we do today. I've been doing for holidays recently. This is the Restaurant Guys. We mostly talk about restaurant food, but. I did, and people are going out to restaurants more and more on holidays. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we find, when we opened 15 years ago, we weren't open on these family holidays. And we responded to the demand that was out there, and we opened as so many restaurants do now. It used to be like the country inn kind of restaurants would be open, but the urban restaurants wouldn't be. But now most restaurants are open on holidays. And what I'm finding is that people are making their tradition a restaurant.
Right.
You know, so there are people who come to us every Easter now, or people that, you know, we're part of their Thanksgiving tradition. And I think that's very interesting. But I still spend, I can't afford to bring my huge Irish Catholic family out to dinner, so we still go to my sister's house. And I have been doing on family gatherings recently something that's sort of seems very 1950s to me. But I've been doing, I did a standing rib roast. Do you all know what that is out there in Radio Land?
What is it, Francis?
They can't answer, can they?
I'm helping them.
A standing rib roast is where you take basically a rack of ribs, and when you do it with pork, it's called a crown roast, and you take the rack, and you basically slice in between each steak, and then you turn it around so it's like a crown, and then you tie it together so it goes around in a circle, and you cook it as a roast.
So, Francis, you know, one of the things you said a little while ago is, you know, you don't go out to restaurants, but I know for a fact that the chef prepared that whole crown roast for you.
Sure.
Set it all up, said, here, put this in the oven for 2 hours. See you tomorrow.
That's the restaurateur's way of cheating. It's true. Well, you're right. Our chef did it. But it's not too difficult to do at home. And actually, a butcher will do that for you if you have a decent butcher. And you say, listen, can you get me a standing rib roast? Now, it took about 2.5 hours to cook. But it cooked as a roast. It cooked very slowly, very little maintenance. You cooked it in a high oven so it browned at like 400 for maybe 45 minutes, and then I dropped it down to 350 for 450 for 40 minutes, and I dropped it down to 350 for maybe 2 hours. And this thing came off, and it was beautiful on the table, and I cooked some root vegetables on the side that I just put in the center of the crown roast. Mm-hmm. And I cut it tableside because it was so beautiful that it was so easy to carve and cut. There's just the rib bones, nothing else. And these huge slabs of meat, perfect medium rare. And if you have someone, the other nice thing about it is you cut each individual rib. If you have someone in your family that's a well-done eater, there are usually some pieces around the edge that are well-done. But if you want to take one of those things back, throw one rib back in the oven, you can have it well-done in 5 minutes.
To do. It's also very, very forgiving. It's not like, you know, putting a chicken in the oven or something like that and you know, it overcooks and it's totally dried out. The rib roasts really, really hold up very well, both the crown roast and a rib roast.
Again, the crown roast is pork and the rib roast is beef. But this was, and this we had plenty of leftovers with 20 people for dinner. I'm going to put up on the website my recipe, which is the recipe the chef gave me, for a rib roast. If you want to try it at home, it's really remarkable and very affordable.
And the most important thing in the rib roast is finding yourself a good butcher.
True.
That is the most important factor. You don't have to be a great cook. You know, season your rib roast first.
How was your Easter dinner?
I had a different experience this Easter.
What?
Actually, you know what? I went to my in-law's house, and a lot of you have heard me talk about my mother-in-law, and she's from the Midwest, and she tends to cook.
As those from the Midwest.
To cook things to higher temperature than I appreciate. And it was great. You know, we had a salad, and she really takes a lot of care, and she puts boiled eggs in it, and bacon, real bacon.
Yeah, yeah, salad, what's next?
And red onions and mushrooms.
Who cares about the salad, what's next?
And, you know, she baked some potatoes, and they were with sour cream and butter and a couple of other side dishes that were really, really great.
And the meat?
But eventually I got to the pork loin.
Yeah.
Sandpaper.
Yeah. How long do you think she cooked the pork
loin? I'm going to say that that pork loin was in the oven at 350 for 3 hours. That's my guess.
Instead of 55 minutes?
Sawdust.
That really begs the question, when does meat become leather?
But that's, you know, they won't eat anything that has red in it still, or pink in it, and especially pork. You know, forget about, you know, all the mystery behind, you know, the bad things that can happen to
pork. We should dispel that mystery now. There's that old mystery I grew up with my mother saying that, you know, you have to cook pork all the way through because you can get trichinosis from it. Actually, almost all pork in the United States is frozen now before you get it, and they flash freeze it in such a way that it kills trichinosis. So the last reported case of trichinosis in the United States was sometime in the 70s.
Well, from
pork.
Pork, right.
Was sometime in the 70s.
Trichinosis still exists. But, yeah, it's a very different way of doing things. So, well, I spend a lot of time on the side dishes and on things like that, and we got
home. Does she ever notice that?
That I spend time on the other dishes?
You don't eat the sandpaper?
Usually I will eat the sandpaper. I'll spread some butter on top of my pork or something like that to loosen it up a little bit. But, yeah, we got home and you know, obviously she doesn't listen to the show, thank goodness.
Yeah.
Or I'd be in big trouble. By the way, if she ever listens to the show, I'm dead.
It'll be the restaurant guy.
Actually, we'll be killed.
The show will be the restaurant
guy. But, you know, it's just one of those things where they like it, you know, really done. I was talking to a show last week about, you know, chicken. They came over our house, and I put the chicken in the oven, and we went out, and they babysat for us. And they put the chicken in the oven for it. It was a regular roasting chicken for an extra hour and a half.
Wow.
After it was finished.
I guess you need to drink a lot of liquids when you have
something. You do. It's hiccups waiting to happen.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to be talking with John Capon, who's a wine expert. He's from Acker, Maryland. We're going to talk about wine auctions and wine fraud. Very exciting and very interesting topic. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:50. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Today, we're joined by John Capon. John is the co-owner and president of auctions at Acker, Maryland Condit. He joined us today to discuss wine auctions, the wine auction business in general, and counterfeit wines, which have been receiving a lot of press recently.
John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Sounds like you have a cool job, man. Wine auctions are things we sort of read about, but they've only become legal in the last 10 or 12 years in New York, right?
Yeah, it was in the early 90s that the laws were changed and allowed us to open up New York as a wine auction market, and over the last 10 years it's become the biggest auction market in the world.
Well, and not only has New York become the biggest auction market in the world, but you've become the biggest auction house in New York. So you weren't an auction house elsewhere. You went from 0 to 60 in 1 second. How'd that happen?
Well, it's been a long road. It's been a 10-year road, and it's been a lot of hard work. We've had to work twice as hard, and you know, we try to refer ourselves jokingly as the anti-Christie. We try to relate to our customers on a more personal level. We're out there tasting the wines with our clients, sharing them, going and promoting a lot of events, and really trying to make fine wine more accessible to the everyday American.
Maybe, you know, maybe we should take a minute and just tell some of our listeners exactly how a wine auction works, exactly, you know, what it's like to be a consumer going to a wine auction.
Well, there are two types of wine auctions that we do. We do live and online auctions. The live auctions, most of the consumers actually send in absentee bids, which are bids that are faxed and emailed to us saying that I would bid up to this amount on a certain lot. It doesn't mean you're going to pay that amount. It depends on the underbidding and the other bidders that are involved bidding against a certain buyer on a certain lot. And basically then people come to the room, some people bid on the phone, and you sit there and raise your paddle if you want something until you win or you back down and someone else. The internet auctions are a great way to get involved and kind of get the feel for the auction. There's smaller quantities, lower value items often, but there's still some wines you'll find in the live auction. Instead of finding 12 bottles, you might find one bottle or things of that nature. And, you know, in a live auction, if you end up buying 15 or 20 lots, you might spend $20,000, but an internet auction can buy 15 or 20 lots and spend $2,000. So it's a good way to kind of get a feel for the auction process if you are new and expose yourself to a greater variety.
We're going to take a break. We'll come right back. We'll be talking more with John Capon of Acker Merrill about wine auctions in general and how maybe you could even get involved in an interesting wine pursuit. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:20.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The maragatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with John Capon, co-owner and president of auctions at Acker Merrill Condit, the wine auction house. Now, John, we were talking before the break about auctions. I think wine auctions have a great romance to them. Are the live wine auctions only for the people who have, you know, 10 grand to drop on wine, or can people come and sort of either spectate or maybe spend a little less, put a toe in the water?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have lots in a live auction that are, you know, $300 or $400. And, I mean, certainly if you're going to end up, you know, if you're going to buy a few things, you know, before you know it, I mean, it's easy to spend $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 before you know it hits you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, wine auctions are definitely something for people that have a little excess money to burn. You can certainly come and spectate. We do them at Crew Restaurant, one of New York City's best restaurants. We just serve lunch and wine with the lunch, and it's a nice afternoon. Obviously, if it becomes to the point where we're overcrowded or we have more reservations than we can handle, we have to serve the existing bidders first.
Now, so if you want to attend the wine auction, is there a fee just to attend the wine auction?
No, absolutely not. You can come. We prefer that you register in advance. You have to register for lunch in advance if you want to have lunch. You know, seating is limited. You know, we can get about, I think we can get about 80 people in there in a given auction before it gets ugly. So, you know, if we know that you're coming in advance, then we can probably accommodate you, because that's usually we end up getting a turnout of about, you know, 50 to 60 people on average every given auction.
You know, if you've never been to an auction of any sort, be it a wine auction or an estate auction or those types of things, they can be very, very exciting and exhilarating. And, you know, you mentioned just a minute ago, John, you know, you can get caught up in that and all of a sudden, you know, be bidding more than you're really comfortable bidding. People need to be very careful about that. But it can be really a lot of fun.
Absolutely. No, the auction is it's a lot of fun for a lot of people. I mean, certainly if you're going to sit there from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and, you know, lot after lot after lot, and there's going to be like 1,000 or 1,200 lots, you really have to kind of be into wine, have a passion for it, you know, to sit through that. There is the, you know, so there are spots where it does, not every lot is a ferocious bidding war between two people. Sometimes they're just going down to the absentee bidder or, you know, to the next buyer. But it's certainly a fun day. It's an exciting way to buy wine. We try to make it more event-oriented with the lunch and with the wine service. And we have a very good community of bidders that have a positive attitude about wine and about the whole culture of wine.
Well, so talk to me about the community of bidders. Who, for the most part, goes to these wine auctions? Is it mostly the same people who are serious wine collectors, or Is it a rotating cast of characters?
Well, it rotates. There's definitely a good core group of bidders who have the fever. There are some people that, you know, send in $100,000 of bids every sale. There are people that come to the room every auction and spend, you know, $50,000 or $100,000. Obviously, you have to have a lot of money to be able to do that. But there are some people come to the room, pick up three or four things every sale and have a nice afternoon, or absentee bidders that send in three or four bids every auction. If they get one, they get one. If they don't, they don't. So it's a wide range of A to Z. You have the corporate stockbroker financial types. You have the doctors, the lawyers, self-made professionals. We do have bidding from Asia and Brazil. There's an international base. And we also have great support from the trade, people that buy the wines from our auctions and go out and sell it to other people at a higher price.
My next question, somebody buys $30,000 wine from you. What are they doing with it?
Well, they're obviously storing it properly, one would hope. You know, they should have a temperature-controlled cellar. There's a lot of professional wine storage options out there. We do that as well for our clients.
I mean, are they buying it to drink? Are they buying it to sit on their mantelpiece? Are they buying it to sell again? What are they doing with it?
Well, I mean, I think that people that buy wine, most of them buy it to drink, but most of the people that also buy wine on a regular basis on this level buy more than they possibly could drink. It's, you know, fine wine has become the Hermes handbag for men. And they need to
nicely
have their bottles
done
to show everybody, and they get off on it. Instead of killing animals, they can have bottles in their cellar or something. And
actually, I'm thinking of a couple of friends of mine who are regulars in the restaurant who go out on safari and kill animals and then come and have a collection.
Right. So it's perfect for them. We got to get them a catalog.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think they come. When people bid online, is that sort of open to anybody to bid online?
Absolutely. You just have to register, you know, and then can bid away. And the difference about the online auction is that it has a live close. You can put in a bid, and if somebody outbids you, you get an email notifying you that you're outbid. You can see where the bidding is at and track it. The live auction is all done absentee. Nobody knows where anything is at. It's kind of you know, because we'll receive 50% of the bids in the last 24 hours, so it wouldn't do much use to a lot of people anyway.
It's not that dissimilar to bidding on a book on eBay. I mean, it's done kind of
the online auction.
The online auction. It's not that dissimilar, is it?
I haven't really done the eBay thing, but I assume that.
Well, it's pretty similar.
Yeah.
You can. I mean, eBay. I've done both and bid on wines in your catalog as well as on eBay. And if you can go on eBay and bid on a chair, you can certainly go to Acker Merrill and bid on a bottle of wine
way. What's the web address where people can go to find out how to get involved at a wine auction?
It's AckerWines.com.
That's AckerWines.com. We're going to link you to that site on our website.
Great.
Now, we're going to take a quick break for the news. When we come back, I want to talk about, it seems as though counterfeiting has become a problem in some wine auctions around the world. Is that the case?
It is a problem. It's not an A to Z problem. It's an A++ problem. It's a lot more limited in scope than the attention it's getting, but it certainly is a problem.
Well, it's sort of interesting because it reminds one of James Bond in like Casino Royale or something. So we're gonna explore that side of things and talk about how maybe if you want to become a wine collector, you can get involved yourself more with John K. Bond of Acker in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, our guest is John Capon. He's the co-owner and president of auctions at Acker Merrill & Condit, the largest and most prominent wine auction house in New York City, which is the largest and most prominent prominent wine auction market in the world. John, we were talking before the break about, you know, I mean, there are guys who drop, you know, 10 grand on a bottle of wine, and there are a lot of guys who drop 10 grand on a case of wine, and that moves this auction market and has made it such a huge industry. But for your average person who may spend a few hundred bucks on a case of wine here and there, when they talk about one of the things I always say, because we used to have a retail store, and we still have a retail license and through our restaurants, and we sell people wine, and we always say, you know, when you're buying wine for yourself, unless you're going big, you're investing in your own future pleasure. It's not really about investing to cash in later. Because I always think, you know, if somebody's got two bottles of this and four bottles of that and six bottles of this, and it's not, you know, big name Bordeaux or Cabernet, that it's not really going to make a great auction item at Acker Merrill or anywhere else. Am I right?
Well, yeah, you are right to some extent. I mean, there are probably, you know, 200 or 300 brands that are really considered auction worthy. And, you know, even if you have three bottles of this or four bottles of that, if it ends up staying in your cellar 5 or 10 years, the older it gets, the more appeal and auction worthy wines become in general, because older wines are obviously rarer than new releases. The great thing about wine is that it literally is a liquid asset. If you buy...
That's funny.
I like it.
It is. I mean, with the way the market's been, I mean, even over the past year or two, prices of certain wines have doubled, and it's becoming more and more of a luxury good at the top level, and the prices of some of the wines, like the first growths, like Lafite and Latour, are pricing themselves away from perhaps the everyday collector, but there certainly are still a large amount of excellent wines available that will appreciate in value slowly and surely. So it's nice to know, hey, well, if you have a wine collection and you need the money, you know, you can turn it into some money.
If you've got a wine collection of wines that, you know, some small producer that nobody ever heard of that we turn you on to or somebody else turns you on to, that's great. And the wine does get better and the wine's amazing. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's auctionable, right?
Correct. You really have to do your homework. You can see we post all our auction results online. You can kind of get a feel for what brands are making their way to the auction.
So Yellowtail's not going big at auction these days.
Right, that you might want to drink.
Actually, I don't want to drink
exactly.
It. Thanks anyway, John.
Give that to somebody else when your mother-in-law comes over.
Right, that's the in-law wine.
Now, we have other issues, and I think it's fascinating. What people need to realize is that there's an investment in even if you buy the right wine, you need to keep that in a temperature-controlled cellar, because you know what? One afternoon in the attic, and you may have stored it properly for 10 years, or one afternoon in the trunk of your car, and you may have stored it properly for 20 years, and you've destroyed the wine. It's a living thing. How does Acker Merrill go about establishing, you know, the provenance of wines and making sure that didn't 5 years ago spend an afternoon in someone's, you know, attic or, you know, get thrown in the pool or whatever?
Well, even the greatest collections will have a lemon here or there. There is, you know, a small degree of risk when purchasing older wines, even when dealing with the most excellent of sources. Our inspection process is a thorough one. First of all, we know who we're dealing with. We don't just take three bottles off somebody who walks up into the store, things like that. You know, we try to deal with only larger collections, people.
So let me just stop you right there. So that's another problem. If you're just a guy who has a few cases in your cellar and you think, oh, I'm going to go and sell this.
Right,
stuff.
You've bought, you know, three cases of first growth Bordeaux and it's in your basement.
But you know, no one trusts that you've kept it properly. I mean, it's going to be harder to sell your wine than if you're an established collector. Am I right?
Well, yeah, it depends. I mean, we still deal with smaller collectors, but something we do for anybody that's new to us, we're going to ask to taste a sample bottle or two or three or four, the larger the collection gets, where we're spot checking for provenance to make sure that there is quality represented in the collection. Often, you know, for people, you know, in the tri-state area and up and down the East Coast of the Mid-Atlantic, out to the Midwest, we'll have often for larger collections, we'll have a representative inspect the cellar, or do a report on the seller, you know, firsthand, or the trucking company that picks up from the seller will let us know that there was temperature-controlled cellar, et cetera, et cetera. And we spot taste. You can check. I mean, you can also tell when you're looking at the bottles. If the bottles are beat up, there's a lot of dirty labels, torn, there's low fills, there's seepage. Chances are it's a collection we're not going to deal with, and mm-hmm. we're going to be sending it back. I mean, you can kind of get a feel for a collection by looking at all the bottles. We have only, you know, two or three people that are authorized to actually inspect and catalog wines, you know, that we do offer for auction. So it's not a question of just inspecting it by number 12 and next, you know. There
right,
is,
right.
It is a process. It is something that we take our time with and we really try to be thorough about. But, you know, like I said, even if you do all that, there's going to be a lemon here or there. And, you know, that's one of the adverse, the counterpoint to that is the prices that you pay at auction, unless you get into a bidding war, generally you're going to save relative to purchasing at retail.
How much? I mean, for, say, a great bottle of Bordeaux from a very good vintage, how much do you is on average, what, as a percentage, would I pay at auction as opposed to if I were going to try and buy it retail?
I would say, you know, on average, probably 30% to 40% at least.
That's pretty big number.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big number.
Especially for those older bottles, because what happens in it when you pay at a liquor store or a fine wine shop or whatever, you know, you're going to pay somebody for, you know, either holding those wines or purchasing those wines aftermarket.
Now, it's been said that it's not only about the provenance and that things were stored properly, but on the high end of things, it's been said that there are more bottles of 1961 Petrus have been sold in Las Vegas in the last 5 years than were ever made. Which is
a
problem.
Yeah, 1982 was the reference.
Oh, 82, that's right.
But, there's definitely been some certain wines like 82 Petrus, some of the older wines like the mega wines of the century, like 47 Cheval Blanc.
Let me just explain to the listeners.
So I'm buying a bottle of Kendall Jackson off the shelf. Is that something I need to worry about?
No.
Well, let me just explain to listeners what we're talking about. Chateau Petrus is a very prominent, prestigious house, makes very expensive wine that's very auctionable, is depreciated in value a great deal. There's not a lot out there. There's not a lot that was made, yet there seems to be an inexhaustible supply in places like Vegas, which, you know, begs the question, some of it has to be counterfeit.
Yeah, Petrus is probably one of the most counterfeited brands of wine out there. Particularly 82, also some of the older wines, you know, like 61, 47, Magnums, when you get into really older wines, tend to be what you see more often than bottles being counterfeit, because if someone's going to go through the headache of counterfeiting something, you might as well make it a double bottle and get the
right.
two or three times the price.
So let me ask you, what is at recent auctions, what would a genuine bottle of 82 Petrus go for?
I think we just sold some at a little under $5,000 a bottle all in.
You know, $5,000 a bottle, it's sort of worth going to the computer printer and trying to fake it out on your guests. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk more with John Capon about what's going on in the auction market today and how that affects fine dining in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps, to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back. Francis and Mark of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Talking with John Capon, co-owner and president of auctions at Acker Maryland Condit. Now, we were talking about counterfeit wines becoming a problem on the super high end. Now, you out there don't have to worry about it. Counterfeiting a bottle of Yellowtail is like counterfeiting a quarter. Nobody really goes to the trouble of doing it. You're going to counterfeit, you counterfeit $100 bills. But on the high end of the market, wines like 82 Petrus, which sell for, you know, thousands, people will go to great trouble to create a facsimile of old bottles of wine. How do the experts
determine whether a bottle is counterfeit or not? What are the clues that, that the experts can figure out?
Well, there's the inspection process is a thorough one. First, we're going to cut the capsule and inspect the branding of the cork. Certain corks, you know, after seeing thousands of bottles of the certain types of wines, you know which cork is correct. In certain areas, they had different corks. And thankfully, most of the Bordeaux branded their corks. Gets a little trickier in Burgundy. Not every Burgundy producer or Rhone producer branded their corks. But generally, I would say that three out of the four wines that have been counterfeited have been Bordeaux over the years.
So by branding the corks, we mean that they've put their stamp on the cork, on the side of the cork, so you can see it through the bottle.
Right. They'll put the date, the Chateau, certain mise en bouteille au Chateau.
What's to keep a counterfeiter from counterfeiting a branded cork?
Well, you know, there are people can take out corks and put them back in the bottle, too. You know, you look for marks on the side of the corks. There's a corkscrew called an ASO, I believe. It's like a two-pronged one. It's aptly named because I feel like one every time I try to use one. But, I'm not good with that. But, you know, so you can see sometimes I've seen, like, twin marks on the side of corks on opposite sides, as if somebody put an ASO and took the cork out, and we would reject the bottle if we saw that. But also, there are, you know, there's some openers now. I saw an opener where you can pump nitrogen in, and it's like a single prong in the middle, and it pops the cork right out, you know, pretty cleanly. So, obviously, old corks can be
manipulated.
Right, used again. You know, the bottle could be open, drunk, consumed, or people would charge for an event or something, and then they could use the cork again or use it to make other corks as a template. You know, one of the tricky things is a lot of the Chateaus in Bordeaux over the years reconditioned their wines, and they would recork and refill their wines legitimately. So some older wines have a newer appearance legitimately. And have a younger cork, so that's one thing you have to look out for.
We should just explain what recorking is. Would you take a second and do that, or
yeah,
reconditioning?
Recorking, reconditioning, it's where a Chateau will take bottles with lower fills and add wine to them, either from the same vintage or even from a younger vintage, to give the wine a better appearance and freshen it up. There's a lot of people that think that this is not a good thing, that the you know, it really kind of strips some of the natural nuances and greatness away from the wines, and it's one of the greatest wine crimes of the 20th century, although done unintentionally and with good intention. You'll never get the A-plus experience with a reconditioned bottle, but you always get an A-minus. It's like getting, like, you know, a sure thing, A-minus, B-plus, as opposed to going for the A-plus. Once you've had that A-plus experience, you sure do want it again.
So, but a bottle that, let's say, has a little less fill to it when you look at it, is that by definition a bad bottle?
No. I had a bottle of Burgundy from 1935 last week that had fill level 3 inches below the cork, which generally we would not even sell if it was given to us, because we try to offer wines with only good fills. There's a better chance. The better the fill, the better the chance that the bottle is good. But there are low-fill bottles that can be spectacular, as this wine was.
Let me explain how a low-fill happens. A cork is not a perfect seal, and what happens over time is wine can sort of evaporate through the cork, or even, in worst-case scenarios, seep out through the cork over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fill goes down in the bottle. And, of course, the less wine that's in there, that means the more oxygen got in there to take its place, or the more air got in that contains oxygen to take its place. And so the wine is at greater and greater risk, because oxygen is what often is the downfall of wine. So that's what we're talking about with fills. And just to fill you all in out there in listener land, when we talk about reconditioning a bottle, I had a friend who used to do a reconditioning locally, and I had a great deal with him. There are a lot of private wine collectors in Jersey that have amazing collections themselves. And what this gentleman would do is say he had some of 82 Petrus, which I'm sure he did. Every 15 years or 11 years, my friend would go in and he'd take one of his 50 bottles of Petrus and he'd uncork them all. And then from one bottle, he would make sure it was perfect and then top all the other bottles up to keep the fills high and then put in a fresh cork. Now this, as John was saying, make sure that the wine doesn't fall too low and too much oxygen doesn't get in there, and it can work as a preservative. But it, it robs you of the A-plus experience, and it also makes your wine harder to sell at auction because it's harder to define the provenance of it. Isn't that correct?
Yes. I mean, there is more uncertainty sometimes, especially nowadays, with reconditioned bottles and whether or not they are authentic. But, you know, that's one of the things also that we look for is the label. Chances are, if the label is glossy or has a glossy kind of facsimile feel to it, we won't offer it as well, because that is another tip-off that we look at. So, you know, if the wine has a legitimate label, the label should have texture to it. It should not be glossy or look, look wrong, you know. And that's and also older wines should have sediment levels in the bottom. There should be some amber at the edges, you know, of an older wine, looking at the color and the sediment levels in the bottom of the bottle is another tip off.
Sounds like you need an expert.
You know, yeah. You know, John, as we get into this, I mean, soon enough we'll be carbon dating our wines and labels.
It'd be great if we could. I mean, if the technology is there, that would be fantastic.
The other thing that's been written about a lot is people will now, when they're looking at making large purchases or doing large transactions like that, there are authentication tastings and authentication dinners where people will invite a number of people who are knowledgeable about wines and randomly pick through a collection and open a bunch of them and ask people's opinions as to whether they think they're legitimate or not. I mean, have you experienced a lot of that?
No, of course. Well, that's, you know, kind of what I was referring to earlier. You know, it's more of a provenance check. It's kind of the same premise, but, you know, wine tastings and events, I mean, that's where I've been able to learn the most about these older and rare wines, getting enthusiasts together and opening up 15 or 20 wines.
Well, and what happens if when we open those wines, people are like, nah, this smells fishy, this doesn't seem like the right deal? Is the deal off? Is that how that works?
Well, this is kind of, I mean, the kind of events that we do that I've done, when I'm dealing with a larger seller, I might go on a personal base. I've had enough experience where I'm exposed to, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 of the world's finest, rarest wines on a yearly basis for the last 10 years. I've seen enough. It's more of an education process on a personal level. I'll deal with certain collectors and taste the majority of wines from their cellar before offering, you know, with them, and especially if it's a lot of older wines. And, you know, like I said, you know, once you've seen enough bottles, you kind of get a feel right away when you, mm-hmm. you look at 10, 15, 20 things, okay. You can kind of get your bearings, but you're still going to want to taste to make sure that someone's done their due diligence. And I've been, you know, a lot of the events, people will bring bottles that they bought for me and, you know, will spot taste and things like that. And if something doesn't show well, then, you know, I might take a closer look at the
sure.
collector. We don't have too many problems with counterfeit wines.
Well, John, we're gonna have to leave it there, but we're going to link people to your site at AckerWines.com.
And I think the biggest message to people is if you're not buying wines that are on a super high-end, you shouldn't worry about counterfeit wines.
Exactly.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us. That's John Capon of Acker Wines. You can find him at AckerWines.com or through our website, RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:56. Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. I find that incredibly interesting, the whole auction thing. You know, the thing about it is wines aren't like currency, and a lot of these old houses would you know, sell a case, a barrel of their wine to someone else who mm-hmm. would put it in bottle, and so that bottle's going to look different. This is, and then we're talking some, you know, some $10,000 bottles of wine that you can't for sure be sure that they're right or not.
Well, except the fact of the matter is once you've tasted 20, 50, 100, and John's tasted some in some of these cases.
Yeah, but you still
100
can't be
of
sure.
these wines. You can't be sure because you don't know what happened to the wine in the interim.
I will always remember. Do you remember Mark and I had a friend, as I alluded to before, who was a wine. He had a wine reconditioning business.
Yeah, I loved that business.
And what he would, yeah, we loved it. Because what he made a good. He was an official reconditioner by the houses in Bordeaux. He was certified, and he would come into their cellar and he would open one. You know, say you had 50 bottles or something. He'd open one. Take out all the corks, taste everything, make sure it was good, and use that one bottle to top up all the others.
So maybe a bottle would need an ounce or a half an ounce, and some bottles wouldn't need any.
And so we're talking about very expensive wines, very mm. old wines from a very wealthy person whose family's been wealthy for generations. And his fee was he got paid very well by the hour, plus time and travel and expenses. And he also got, you know, you're left with a half a bottle of this, a half a bottle of that, three quarters
quarter
of a bottle
of this, right.
Which you can't really do anything with. because if it's not a full bottle, it'll go bad.
And that's not true. You can do something
and
with
his
it.
Fee was he got to keep the partial bottles of all these amazing wines. And so his deal with us was he would show up with a case of, you know, $50,000
right.
worth of wine.
57 this, 45 this,
and our deal was,
81 this,
but you had to drink it that night.
Right.
So his deal was he would finish his job, drive to the restaurant, and he'd do this like three nights in a row. We would provide dinner, and he would open some of the most amazing wines in the world.
One of the best tasting experiences of my life.
Oh, my God, amazing. Well, sorry you couldn't be there with us, but I hope you've enjoyed living vicariously through us and the Restaurant Guys for one more hour. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time, right now, is 12 noon.